Also, you know, this has not been very hard for me to think about. I mean, I was for Palestinian rights. That was part of my political formation growing up as a teenager in India, because, you know, India's own experience of colonialism, which was horrific, it just made it very, very clear that we would be for Palestine, but without ever marginalizing the suffering of Jews, not just in the Shoah, but centuries of European anti-Semitism. These were part and parcel of our anti-colonial identity. It's for the same reason that we were against apartheid South Africa. It was for the same reason that we were for civil rights in the United States. And now, it is basically a coming together of these ethno-nationalist muscular states that admire each other. And that's what the Hindu right is, and that's what the Israel is, and the United States supports them both.
And we just have 10 seconds, but you're a professor at the New School. The New School has just set up a faculty encampment, maybe the first in the country, to defend the students, the significance of this.
I absolutely absolutely find it amazing. I think the students have been incredibly inspiring. We would not have found out about the New School's complicity in Israeli weapons manufacturing in the war, and the students have actually made that clear. And so, yes, it's our duty as faculty in a place that touts social justice to stand with them.
Siddharth Deb, award-winning Indian journalist, born in Northeast India. His latest book is called Twilight Prisoners.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and KBOO's spring membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to 44321 between now and May 25th and support Avant-Garde Airwaves.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. With an increase in violent crime, child abuse, and domestic violence, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office is asking for more money in next year's budget. Money is also on the minds of many parents and students. Portland Public Schools leader is talking about financial aid. And the election season is here. What polling says about the rural-urban divide among voters. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 9th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I am Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us tonight. Today, it was the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department's turn to ask for hundreds of millions of dollars to fund public safety. Leaders in the Sheriff's Department talked about the need to increase their budget to Multnomah County commissioners.
I'm Kerry Kerr, Chief Deputy of the Law Enforcement Division, and I'm pleased to be with you to cover the great work we're doing in our community. The Enforcement Support Unit, responsible for law enforcement records and programs managing alarms and concealed handgun licenses, were all moved to my division to better align their work with the rest of our traditional police services. In addition, TriMet provided funding to allow for new positions within the Transit Police Division. Throughout the year, MCSO worked many focused initiatives with our local partners to include Gresham Police, Portland Police, the Multnomah County DA's Office, the U.S. Marshals, local businesses, and community-based organizations. These initiatives were a proactive, multi-layered measure developed to address the ended levels of gun violence and traffic fatalities, as well as retail theft and stolen vehicles in our community, and to meet the need for community-engaged policing. We appreciate the board's support of two very important proclamations brought forward by the DA's office just last month, highlighting the invaluable work related to child abuse prevention and support for crime victims. MCSO members work hand in hand with advocates and the DA's office in the prosecution work relating to these important initiatives. The Law Enforcement Division remains deeply invested in a data-driven approach to tracking crime trends and developing strategies to provide effective public safety services in our community. Yesterday at the 2024 Employee Recognition Ceremony, our detectives were recognized for their exceptional work. Even with the new and continued investments in fiscal year 24, focused on child abuse and violent crime, MCSO has an astronomical need for stable investments in detectives. We are gravely concerned with the lack of funding for two detective positions in this year's fiscal year 25 proposed budget. Over the past budget cycles, the MCSO has lost funding for detective positions investigating human trafficking, elder abuse, internet crimes against children, child abuse, and gun violence. The investigations unit volume of cases over the calendar year of 2023 and the triage for prioritization that follows. As an example, after Oregon passed legislation in 2017 related to how reports of child abuse are investigated, there was a period of uncertainty about the level of resource we would need, primarily because of the COVID-19 pandemic. It became very clear in 2022 that there was a need to dedicate a specialized detective to investigate these cases. We've been concerned about the stability of funding for detective positions and continue to be concerned in fiscal year 25. For child abuse specifically, statute directs that all reports of child abuse to Oregon Department of Human Services be reviewed by law enforcement. Based upon the number of child abuse reports alone, MCSO must complete preliminary reviews and only move cases forward for investigation that involves significant criminal components. Other cases are delayed or may not be able to be fully investigated. The ability to dedicate a specialized detective to investigate these cases supports the safety all children should have. The number of child abuse cases in our jurisdiction, which primarily in East County, continues to grow and consistent with countywide picture. The loss of a child abuse detective would be devastating to our young, vulnerable population. In the first quarter of 2024, there have been 203 child abuse cases. At this rate, we are on pace to exceed the 790 cases in all of 2023. The same is true for person crimes. This includes violent acts such as assault, rape, or arson. In these cases, we must also triage the assignments to detectives. As an example, a major crimes team call out for a murder investigation last week required 10 deputies and officers from MCSO with assistance from Portland Police and 10 detectives to respond. We also had 3 crime scene investigators from Gresham Police assist. This is an example of the major crime team model we use due to the small number of detectives MCSO has at our disposal. MCSO works closely with our surrounding agencies to provide additional detectives and resources to ensure a thorough and timely investigation when serious crimes occur. The Sheriff's Office has been aligned with Every Town for Gun Safety and Moms Demand Action to address growing access to illegal firearms and intimate partner violence. We often share Every Town's data related to domestic violence, stating in the U.S., crisis of domestic violence is closely linked to the widespread and growing use of guns by abusers. Nearly 1 million women alive today have reported being shot or shot at by intimate partners. And over 4.5 million women have reported being threatened with a gun by an intimate partner. 2/3 of women killed by an intimate partner are killed with a gun. MCSO has had 2 deputies within the civil unit for fiscal year 24, working as a team focused on connecting with our system partners to follow up with those served with protection orders to dispossess firearms. They have facilitated the surrender of 72 firearms just during the first quarter of this year. These dedicated resources removed deadly weapons from those deemed at risk to themselves or others, preventing a lethal opportunity of future violence.
The Multnomah County Commissioners are holding a total of 3 public hearings this month before they vote on a final budget plan in June. And as we just heard, one of the key issues the Sheriff's Department is looking at is an increase in domestic violence cases. It's a problem locally and nationally. Today, a group of experts met in an online summit about the country's treatment of domestic violence laws. Here's a nationally recognized expert on domestic violence and reform of the court system, Emily Sack with the National District Attorneys Association.
For most of our history, domestic violence was actually condoned by the legal system. And in fact, the idea was that husbands had a right to correct the behavior of their wives. And they were only limited by the fact that they should use a whip no wider than their thumb. And that is where the phrase rule of thumb actually comes from. So I always bristle when I hear that phrase. I'm sure most people who use it don't realize that's the history of it. In any event, even though that history faded for about 100 years, domestic violence still continued to be tolerated. It was not treated like a crime. It was a private family matter. And this really is an ancient history, at least not to me, in the sense that I was working in this field at the time in the late 1980s, early 1990s, where it was the overt policy of the police not to interfere in a domestic violence incident. At most, they would tell the abuser to take a walk around the block. They would often collude with the abuser and joke around and ask the victim, what have you done to provoke him? Or why are you still here? Or we don't believe you, because if it was really that bad, you would have left. I was a criminal defense lawyer in the early 1990s, and I represented a woman who had been severely abused by her husband, and ultimately she killed him. There had been a very long history of abuse, and she had called the police many times. She had been shot at by him. She had been forced to have sex at gunpoint. And to sum it up, they really did nothing. When they came to the house, they never talked to her alone. The husband always said nothing was wrong. There was one time when she called 911 and her husband pulled the phone out of the wall. This is in the days of landlines. And nobody ever came to the house or followed up or anything about that. And there were no services for domestic violence victims other than a few shelters that had been developed through grassroots efforts. This was the landscape. And I would also say that the society at the time really didn't pay much attention to this either. In the case of my client, she worked at a flower shop. She saw a lot of customers, had co-employees. Nobody said anything. She used to wear dark tights, even in a hot summer day, to hide her bruises. Nobody said that, et cetera. And her own family basically said, this is how it is, put up with it. So by the time we get to the early 1990s, when the Violence Against Women Act was being considered, and this was really a four-year battle led by then Senator Biden. I actually worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee as a law student when this was all being considered. And it was fought at every turn. You have to understand that this was a real battle. This was really a watershed. It was the first comprehensive federal legislation designed to end violence against women. And it was important both for the actual substantive provisions, but it was also important symbolically because it was saying the national government thinks this is an issue and doesn't think the states are doing enough. And the bill had several criminal provisions. It also had some other types of provisions and funding, one of which was the firearms ban on protection orders. It also contained a bunch of other provisions. It required that protection orders in one state be recognized in another state so that a woman who's fleeing across state lines could actually have her order recognized. And the act is reauthorized every couple of years so that it is expanded substantially to offer civil legal assistance, protections for immigrant DV victims, and also to expand tribal jurisdiction to prosecute DV crimes on Native lands. There's someone working on that issue in Wyoming. The laws themselves have been highly influential, but also the Violence Against Women Act itself has been a model for states to try to pass their own laws about these subjects. There's still a lot more that needs to be done, but it definitely was a major shift.
Emily Sack is a lawyer with the National District Attorneys Association. Today, Interim Superintendent of Portland Public Schools, Sandy Husk, joined top leaders with the U.S. Secretary of Education's office to talk about student financial aid and getting families and students ready to file for much-needed assistance for their education.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor to be here today representing Portland Public Schools, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to discuss the critical importance of FAFSA completion for our students' success beyond high school. I really want to extend my sincerest thanks to the U.S. Department, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Education for inviting me to share our strategies, methods, and experiences. At Portland Public Schools, we understand the crucial role that FAFSA completion plays in ensuring our students have access to the financial resources necessary to pursue not only higher education, but ultimately to achieve their dreams. We've acquired our high rates of FAFSA completion using strategies that extend beyond the traditional school day. All are dependent on the dedication and collaboration of teachers, counselors, community partners, parents and guardians who work tirelessly to support our students. By leveraging their expertise and resources, they can address the unique needs of each student and help them overcome any barriers to FAFSA completion. One of our key strategies is the deployment of college coordinators at every Portland Public School high school. They work hand in hand with school counselors to provide personalized assistance to students. They guide them through the FAFSA process and even help them create their individual account. They involve the parents and guardians. They invite them to contribute to their child's financial aid journey. We believe being flexible is essential. In addition to regularly scheduling appointments for students, we offer drop-in sessions that allow students to get assistance whenever their schedules permit. For months now, we have organized numerous family nights across the district in multiple languages in collaboration with colleges and local universities. These events provide invaluable opportunities for families to learn about financial aid options, speak one-on-one to higher education reps, and get hands-on support in completing FAFSA. We also recognize the importance of embedding college readiness and career readiness into our curriculum. And we've integrated some of these activities into our family nights, including AVID, which stands for Advancement Via Individual Determination, the scope and sequence that program provides. Our partnerships with numerous and diverse organizations like the Black United Fund allow us to extend, so this makes sure our assistance is available when students need it most. At Portland Public Schools, these efforts are driven by our commitment to equity and inclusivity. We strive to ensure access for all students so that opportunities that may otherwise be out of reach are within reach. And by working together as a community, we're creating a brighter, more inclusive future for all our students. Thank you so much for allowing us to share from Portland Public the activities we've done to be sure that students are getting what they need.
That was Interim Superintendent of Portland Public Schools, Sandy Husk. You are listening to a Spring Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. I'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear skies, down to an overnight low of 54. Tomorrow's weather, mainly sunny, a high of 89. Today in history, on this date in 1960, the FDA approved the pill, the world's first commercially produced birth control pill. The quote of the day is from Margaret Sanger. Birth control is the first important step a woman must take toward the goal of her freedom. It's election season with the main primary underway in Oregon. As Mike Moen reports, a new poll outlines rural voters' priorities, but party labels still cloud results.
President Joe Biden was in Wisconsin Wednesday, touting plans for a new Microsoft data center. The visit comes amid new polling data in battleground states about what's on the minds of rural voters, with organizers noting surprising results. The poll, released by the Rural Democracy Initiative, included feedback from Wisconsin voters. 57% of respondents said they favored a more economic populist vision, with policies centered around lowering costs and raising incomes for the working class. Breakthrough Campaigns researcher Patrick Toomey, who helped lead the poll, says that approach appears more popular than one often touted by GOP politicians.
Just cutting taxes and getting rid of regulations is not going to do the most to help me in this economy.
And while economic policies aligned with Democrats, like minimum wage hikes, are favorable in this poll, many rural voters indicated they think Republicans are doing more for working people. Analysts say that shows Democrats have work to do to rebuild trust in rural areas. Meanwhile, three-quarters of respondents either support abortions or don't want the government interfering with decisions on reproductive health care. Toomey says it will take some time for Democrats to reconnect with these voters and that it won't completely turn around in this election cycle. But he suggests it's not completely hopeless for the party to make gains in rural America ahead of November's vote.
One of the key learnings here is that there are enough voters in rural areas of battleground states who are up for grabs to determine the outcome of 2024.
He suggests if Democrats are savvy with their outreach, they might be able to convince rural populations that they're pursuing policies these voters have outlined as a top priority. More than 1,700 voters in 10 states were part of the poll. As for Biden's appearance, it was at the same location as the fail of the Foxconn project announced by former President Donald Trump several years ago. This is Mike Moen.
2024 Republicans seek to prevent nearly non-existent illegal non-citizens voting. House Speaker Johnson survives a motion to remove him. And a Georgia appeals court will reconsider whether Fulton County District Attorney Willis is to be bumped from a Trump case. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2024 Talks.
Even if you weren't concerned about the drop boxes and the ballot harvesting and the mail-in ballots in 2020, you definitely should be concerned that illegal aliens might be voting in 2024.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says non-citizens are voting in federal elections, but he's not offering proof. Johnson is repeating the conspiracy theory that Democrats are letting a wave of aliens in so they can illegally vote for President Joe Biden. He's backing legislation to require proof of citizenship to get a ballot. Meanwhile, Johnson easily survived a vote Wednesday to remove him as Speaker after Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene finally made good on a threat.
Declaring the office of Speaker of the House of Representatives to be vacant. Uniparty for the American people watching.
Only 11 Republicans voted with her. A Georgia appeals court will reconsider whether Fulton County DA Fannie Willis can stay on the state's election interference case against former President Donald Trump. Defendants claim Willis should be removed for a romantic relationship with her special prosecutor, who Willis says has resigned.
You're confused. You think I'm on trial. These people are on trial for trying to steal an election in 2020. I'm not on trial, no matter how hard you try to put me on trial.
It's now unlikely the case against Trump and 14 allies will go to trial before the election. Meanwhile, the judge in Trump's separate classified documents case has indefinitely postponed that trial date. Retired federal judge Shira Shindlin tells CNN the Florida judge has been slow walking that case by not ruling on 8 different motions.
She puts it all off, then she says there are many complex issues regarding classified documents, and that's true. But if she had done her job, there wouldn't be 8 left. There might be 3, and she could set a trial date.
Some progressives are cheering Biden's move to pause a weapons shipment to Israel over concern for civilians in Rafah. But Republicans say the president is defying Congress after a multi-billion-dollar Israeli aid package passed last month. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham calls it obscene.
Give Israel what they need to fight the war they can't afford to lose. This is Hiroshima and Nagasaki on steroids.
Biden says he could also block other weapons if Israel goes into Rafah. Leaders of 3 large public school systems in California, Maryland, and New York told a congressional panel they're fighting anti-Semitism with education and discipline. Republicans argue the K-12 schools haven't done enough. But New York City Chancellor David Banks says lawmakers were looking for a gotcha moment.
We have some teachers who have had some of these challenges, but we've had members of Congress who've made anti-Semitic statements, and I certainly would not cast aspersions on this entire institution.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A TikTok lawsuit gets some support against a Block Montana ban, and fresh, organic, and Alaskan. That's one tribe's response to hunger. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes say Montana's TikTok ban, if implemented, would overstep tribal sovereignty. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the tribes filed a brief this week to join the legal battle over the ban.
The Salish and Kootenai tribes side with opponents of the TikTok ban as the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals considers the 2023 law. A federal district court last fall threw out the ban, saying it would violate free speech rights as well as the Federal Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The tribes say it would violate the nation's right to issue its own rules and regulations on the Flathead Reservation. The brief also said that social media plays an outsized role in disseminating official information from tribal governments. That's because many people lack high-speed internet at home and largely rely on their phones. A new federal law will ban the social media app if its China-based parent company doesn't sell the app within a year. TikTok is suing the U.S. over that law. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The Kowalungan tribe of Unalaska, Alaska launched a new program to provide fresh, organic, Alaska-sourced food to the entire Aleutian community and to some regional partners. KUCB's Andy Lusk reports organizers held a distribution trial run this spring.
At the event, Unalaskans came to the tribe's food bank and received bags full of carrots, potatoes, cabbage, and beef, all completely free. That produce and meat came from a family farm in Palmer. The tribe is interested in partnering with multiple providers over the course of the program, including local fishermen. Tanea Horn is the tribe's COO. She says the program is part of their ongoing wellness initiatives and aims to support Alaska farmers by offering their products to locals looking for high-quality, minimally processed foods.
For Alaska Native people, for American Indian people, our love language is food. That is how we show that we want to be partners with you and we want to show you that we care about you.
The project first developed last spring when the Kowalungan tribe met with USDA representatives at an economic summit. The tribe was ultimately awarded over $2 million for the project through the USDA's Local Food Purchase Assistance Program. The project came together in partnership with the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, who helped facilitate rollout of produce and meat to tribal organizations across the Aleutian Islands region. Anfisa Tudiakoff is the Kowalungan tribe's cultural director.
So the more that we're able to harvest our natural foods on island and use natural foods from these farmers, you're getting less and less processed foods as the more that we do these kinds of programs.
Tribal Services Manager Marie Schomer says that during the trial run, around 5,000 pounds of food arrived and was distributed to the community.
I love doing it personally because a lot of families out here are struggling just because of the cost of food. And if you're able to give them a couple bags of fresh produce and meat, it's very helpful.
In Unalaska, there are no income restrictions to participation. Anyone is welcome to take food, whether they're a member of the Kowalungan tribe or not. The next event is slated for late April. Horn says she expects the program to do biweekly food bank events by the summer.
That was Andy Lusk reporting, and I'm Jill Freitas.
This weekend, it's Mother's Day, and in honor of the holiday, here's a puzzle for you to ponder. For more, we go to Pearl Stark from KPOV Bend with a point puzzle. A weekly radio puzzle challenging listeners with words and logic.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to take a five-letter word and repeat it. Insert a filler word in the first copy, and phonetically, you now have a two-word phrase for something you might find at the movies. Well, the answer is sound. Double it and insert to get surround sound. Our winner this week is Molly Spees, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon. She says, ooh, what do you hear in these sounds? And ooh, what do you hear in these sounds? I say I hear it. This week, we've got a Mother's Day puzzle. Start with a famous dog, insert a mother, and you get something you might be planting now. So again, start with a famous dog, insert a mother, and you get something you might be planting. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday. This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of May 6th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 9th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mike Moen and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Willamette on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, coming up next. Thank you.